From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Why is the U.S. blocking an international criminal court? Is it afraid its dirty tricks will result in soldiers being brought to trial for crimes against humanity? Also, U.S. Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering has gotten world attention for his role in Nigeria. But what about his role in the cover-up of the murder of four church women in El Salvador? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Dealt a stunning defeat at the polls, Japanese Prime Minister Hashimoto announced today he will resign, and he acknowledged voter frustration over his failure to bring Japan out of its deepest recession in decades. The sudden resignation threw Japanese politics into confusion and was, for the time being, almost certain to impede efforts to pull the economy out of its worst economic mess since World War II. Business leaders immediately voiced concerns that a political vacuum could sidetrack reform efforts already underway. Hashimoto grimly conceded defeat and said he would resign after his Liberal Democratic Party won just 44 seats out of the 126 contested, half of Parliament's upper house, in yesterday's election. This news from Northern Ireland, a contentious parade by Protestant Irishmen through a Catholic area of Belfast passed off peacefully. The march by several hundred members of the Orange Order along Belfast's lower Ormo Road, which has sparked rioting and unrest in the past, was initially delayed by a bomb alert. Bomb squads carried out a controlled explosion on a suspect device found in a litter bin after evacuating people living nearby. A telephone warning had been received from the Irish National Liberation Army. The march in Belfast by the staunchly Protestant Orange Order was taking place 24 hours after three Catholic children were burned alive in a sectarian attack that horrified Protestants and Catholics alike. The march went ahead after Catholic local residents agreed to stage only a, quote, dignified silent protest as the Orangemen went past. And this news from Nigeria. Days after he died in custody, Nigeria's most prominent political prisoner made an eloquent appeal from the grave for an end to military rule and for freedom for his people. In the letter to Nigerian human rights leader Gani Fawahimi, published in Nigeria, Mashood Abiola said it was only a matter of time before the military was forced from power. "Time searches out and destroys all things," Abiola wrote in the letter published in the Lagos-based Tribune newspaper. Although not dated, references indicate the letter was written sometime after he met June 30th with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Abiola died Tuesday while meeting with a group of visiting U.S. officials shortly before he was expected to be released. His death set off rioting in Lagos and the southern Nigerian towns of Ibadan and others. At least 55 people have died, more than 400 were arrested. According to the preliminary findings of an independent autopsy, Abiola died of a heart attack. His supporters argue that medical neglect over 4 years of solitary confinement set the stage for the fatal heart attack. He was buried Saturday in a garden ceremony at his Lagos home, where thousands filled the streets outside to say goodbye. Toxicological studies of his tissues have yet to be completed. Abiola described in the letter the isolation and despair of life after 4 years in prison. He wrote, "I was like a man put in an open grave." His newspaper yesterday published excerpts from a diary detailing abusive treatment by guards, health problems, and boredom during imprisonment. The Sunday Concord in Nigeria said the diary had been written on scattered slips of paper, including the wrapping of toilet tissue rolls, and had been smuggled to his family during his detention for declaring himself president. The paper said Abiola complained of subhuman treatment from his captors, quote, "most often shouting on me to shut up when I make complaints or seek to request medical attention." The most detailed part of the diary, which the family has not yet decided whether it will publish in full, deals with Abiola's health problems. In what diplomats say is the first endeavor of its kind, the United States and 20 other countries will meet in Oslo today to try to stop the spread of assault rifles, pistols, hand grenades, small mortars, and other so-called light weapons. The conference reflects a growing realization among governments that in the post-Cold War world, it is not the jets and tanks, but the small arms that are the prime contributors to regional instability, fueling nationalistic and ethnic wars where the casualties have been in the tens of thousands. While most governments supported the landmine agreement, the Clinton administration fought the ban and will not sign the treaty. And New York Congressmember Charles Rangel has called for a federal investigation of charges that the Cuban-American National Foundation spent at least $200,000 over the years to pay for bombings and other provocative attacks inside Cuba. A series of reports in the New York Times quotes the man identified as a Cuban exile who says he spent that money in terrorist attacks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In one of the most startling developments in the case of four church women murdered in El Salvador in 1980, newly declassified State Department documents have revealed that in 1985, then U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador, Thomas Pickering, was told by the Salvadoran defense minister that he suspected high-ranking military officials had ordered the murders of three nuns and a lay worker. This at a time when the U.S. government was asserting that no high-ranking officers were involved in the slayings. Even after Thomas Pickering's conversation with the defense minister, the U.S. continued to deny any high-level involvement. These documents became public only within the last few weeks. Pickering's name has been in the news in the last week because now, as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, he's the U.S. envoy who was meeting with political prisoner Mashoud Abiola in Nigeria when Abiola died. Right now, we're joined by William Ford. He's the brother of Ida Ford, who was a Mary Null nun raped and murdered in El Salvador in 1980. That is the subject of these documents that have been recently declassified. William Ford is an attorney based here in New York City. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Can you tell us about these documents that have been released over the last few weeks and what they say about the murder of your sister and the other church women?
For more than 15 years, the State Department has insisted to the families that it had no evidence of higher orders in the murder of my sister and the other three women. And in fact, the State Department has long insisted that it had evidence too sensitive to release, that there were no higher orders. They had evidence to prove the negative, no higher orders. After years of trying to get information, after unsuccessful Freedom of Information Act suits, within the past month we have had the documents released to us which clearly demonstrate that the State Department has been lying to us for 15 years. There is no proof in these documents, call the special embassy evidence by Judge Tyler, that there were no higher orders. On the contrary, there are a number of documents which say that the Salvadoran government officials themselves believed that higher military officers were involved in the murders. I am particularly disappointed in Ambassador Pickering's role because I can specifically remember a conversation that Pickering and I had just before the trial of the guardsmen. Pickering said that the situation was too delicate to investigate a cover-up, but as soon as the trial was over, that the United States government would insist on such an investigation. Obviously, there has been no investigation, and in fact, two of the Salvadoran officers who are reliably reported to have known about the orders to kill the women before they were killed are now living a comfortable retirement in Florida, obviously not on a Salvadoran Army pension.
Who are they?
General Vitas Casanova and General Garcia.
And what do you mean, obviously not on a Salvadoran military pension?
Well, the pension paid to a Salvadoran officer at that level might be somewhere between U.S. dollars, $200 and $400 a month. These men live in large houses, drive very large modern American or foreign cars, and obviously live in a very upper middle class lifestyle. They have houses on the waterfront, boats, and all the other indicia of people who have access to large amounts of money.
And so what are you suggesting? How do they get by?
Well, for these two men to jump to the head of a immigration line to get into Florida suggests that there was not complicity, but direct action by U.S. government agencies to get them out of El Salvador and into Florida. Obviously, there are a lot of people left in El Salvador who don't like Vitas Casanova or General Garcia, and their friends in the U.S. government took them out of El Salvador and put them into Florida. There, at the very least, there should be a subpoena issued to these people to come to Washington to testify under oath about what they knew and what they know about the murders of the church women.
We're talking to William Ford. He is an attorney based in New York. He's the brother of Ida Ford, the Mary Knoll nun who was raped and murdered in El Salvador in 1980 with three other women, with two other nuns and a religious lay worker. For listeners who are not familiar with this infamous case, this notorious case that took place in 1980, it is 18 years ago. I am sure it is extremely painful for you to talk about William Ford. But can you describe what exactly took place as it has been reconstructed?
Well, in 1980, my sister Ida and a number of other North American religious answered the call of the Salvadoran church to come down and help the refugees in their civil war. Ida got to Salvador in April of 1980, just after the murder of Romero, and she spoke about the trauma of the people caught in this death and murder machine. Ida was distributing food and medicines to the Salvadoran people, which had been donated by the West German bishops. The work of Ida Ford and Maura Clark was seen by the Salvadoran government as a threat because they were aiding the people. About 3 weeks before Ida's death, she was told by a Colonel Peña Arbeza, who ran the military district of Chalatenango, where Ida lived and worked, that Ida and Maura Clark were subversives because they were aiding the poor, and the poor were the enemy of the government of El Salvador. Obviously, my sister and Maura Clark were seen as threats by the Salvadoran military. They were witnesses to what was going on, and they were bringing food and medicine to the people. So, obviously, a decision was made that these women were to be eliminated, to be murdered. And on December 2nd, returning to the airport in San Salvador after a meeting of the Mary Knoll Central American region in Nicaragua, the women were intercepted after having been met by Dorothy Kazel and Gene Donovan. They were intercepted by the five guardsmen leaving the airport. They were taken to a country road where they were brutalized and then shot in the head.
And how did you find out who had killed them?
Well, that was a process that took place after a number of years. The identities of the guardsmen who killed the women were known shortly after they were killed. The U.S. Embassy had found that out. However, it was not until about 18 months after the deaths of the women that we learned the identities of the guardsmen who were being held, the men who were at the scene. These were not the men who ordered the crime, but these were the ones who actually carried it out. In fact, I can remember a bizarre conversation I had with Napoleon Duarte, who was then president of El Salvador, telling me it would be a violation of the civil rights of the men in captivity to release their names to us.
Hmm. We're also joined on the phone with us, William Ford, by Scott Greathead. He's an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. Earlier this year, he interviewed several of the National Guardsmen who were convicted of the murder of your sister, as well as two other nuns and the church worker in El Salvador in 1980. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott Greathead.
Good morning. Thanks.
And you were the group, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, who got the documents that the State Department handed over, the so-called special embassy evidence of the 1980 murders.
That's correct.
We were just talking to William Ford about the latest information we have at this point and the issue of higher orders, and also bringing in one of the headliners of these last few weeks, Thomas Pickering, currently the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, who was with Masoud Abiola when he died in Nigeria. And looking back at his role as ambassador in El Salvador in 1980s, the late 1980s, when these documents indicate that he had a conversation with a Salvadoran military official who said that the Salvadoran military did believe that the National Guardsmen were working on higher orders, something William Ford points out he did not tell the families or the world, for that matter.
Well, actually, what the memos say is that he had conversations in 1985 with two high-ranking Salvadoran army officers, Guillermo Garcia, who was the Minister of Defense at the time of the murders, and General Flores Lima, who was another high-ranking member of the Salvadoran military. And Flores Lima told him that at the time of the murders, Garcia had suspected that a lieutenant colonel, whose name was Edgardo Casanova, was involved in the murders because something similar had happened shortly before the murders in his zone of responsibility. Lieutenant Colonel Edgardo Casanova was the military commander of the Zacatecoluca military area where the murders actually occurred. And for that reason, Garcia had Casanova transferred from Zacatecoluca back to the military headquarters in San Salvador, presumably so that he could keep an eye on him or perhaps to avoid any disclosure that a lieutenant colonel was involved in the murders. This was information that we've been trying to get for a long time, and it has been denied for many, many years by the State Department. I am not sure exactly who made the decision in 1985 not to disclose to us these conversations that Ambassador Pickering had with members of the Salvadoran High Command. I'm not sure that it was Ambassador Pickering who decided that it shouldn't be disclosed. In any case, it's something that we want pursued. We want pursued vigorously now.
William Ford, the conversation that you had with Thomas Pickering, was that the only one that you had when he said, we will pursue a cover-up investigation after the trial of the National Guardsmen?
Yes, I remember that conversation with the ambassador because I and the other family members, and of course also the Lawyers Committee, which has been on our side here for 18 years, was continually pressing the embassy to investigate the question of higher orders. Whose idea was this? Who ordered this crime? Then who covered it up? Pickering essentially brushed aside my request to investigate the question of higher orders, but said that the political climate in Salvador with the coming trial of the Guardsmen was so delicate that the U.S. Embassy didn't want to do anything at that time to upset the apple cart. But once the Guardsman's trial had been concluded, that the embassy would insist on an investigation into the cover-up of the murders of these women. And there is no question, and even the U.S. government admits, that there was a pervasive, continuing, and obviously effective cover-up into the murders and into the question of who above the level of these five guardsmen was involved.
And that cover-up, you are saying here, was also done by the U.S. government.
Well, I'm saying that it was the Salvadoran military which was seeking to cover up the participation by its senior officers into the crime. The Reagan administration had a broader view. They wanted to continue aid to this murder machine, and they didn't want any additional public embarrassment into the United States. The murder of the four churchwomen was a tremendous public relations and political problem for the U.S. government, for the Reagan administration, and they dealt with it as a political problem rather than a homicide investigation.
We're talking to William Ford, who is the brother of Ida Ford, killed in El Salvador in 1980. She was one of three nuns and one religious lay worker who were raped and killed by National Guardsmen in El Salvador. We're also joined by Scott Greathead, an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. We're going to come back with them to finish up this conversation. And then we're going to talk about the International Criminal Court meeting, which is happening right now as we speak in Rome for the past 5 weeks, is wrapping up, and we'll find out just what is the state of an international criminal court. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're finishing up our conversation with William Ford and Scott Greathead. Scott Greathead, the attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, who earlier this year interviewed several of the National Guardsmen who were convicted of the murder of three nuns and a church worker in El Salvador in 1980. The Lawyers Committee has been on this case for 18 years now. William Ford, the brother of Ida Ford, one of the people killed on that day. We're having this conversation today because in the last week's new information has just surfaced, declassified documents that indicate that, as opposed to what the U.S. government has said about not being aware of higher orders given to these National Guardsmen who were involved in the killing of these three nuns and church worker, it does turn out that Ambassador Pickering, ambassador to El Salvador in 1985, 86, 87, who is now the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, most notably in the headlines in the last week because he was with Masoud Abiola when he died in Nigeria, that Ambassador Pickering had a conversation with two high-level Salvadoran officers who said they believed that the National Guardsmen were working on higher orders when they killed the church women. William Ford, you have just told us that you had a conversation with Ambassador Pickering just before the National Guardsmen on trial, who said that it should be investigated whether there had been a cover-up, but that he never told you or the other families, in fact, that he had information from the military that there was high-level involvement with these killings. What difference would that have made?
Well, it would have enabled the families to bring this information to the American people because, remember, during the 1980s in El Salvador, somewhere between 70 and 80,000 people were killed, most of them by munitions, bombs, and planes made in the United States and sent down to El Salvador. I think that as far as the families are concerned now, we are facing at least a temporary dead end in El Salvador because the government has indicated that it will not continue the investigation. It will not reopen the investigation. The governor has also indicated that three of the five guardsmen, including Kalinda Zaliman, are likely to be released. In fact, their release has been approved. Whether or not an appeal will be taken by the government is a question that will be probably resolved sometime this week. But what the United States government can do presently, directly, and relatively easily is subpoena the two men who are living in Florida, General Garcia and General Vitas Casanova, and call them to Washington to testify publicly under oath about what they knew and when they knew it about the murders of my sister and the other three women and the subsequent cover-up. And they should be asked who in the United States government was getting information from the Salvadoran government about the knowledge held by the Salvadoran military about these murders.
Scott Greathead, do you think that the tide in El Salvador could have turned when Ambassador Pickering got word that even the Salvadoran military said that these National Guardsmen had been operating with orders from above, that this could have changed U.S. policy towards El Salvador, leading to tens of thousands fewer deaths in the country?
Well, certainly, if we'd known about this in 1985, we could have pursued the case against Lieutenant Colonel Edgardo Casanova in Salvador. When I was in Salvador in March, and we had been told by four of the five guardsmen that they had been acting under higher orders, that their superior, Sergeant Kalindra Salaman, the guy who was the ringleader of the group, had told them that he had higher orders and none of them would have done this without higher orders. We took that information to the fiscal general, who's the equivalent of El Salvador's attorney general, and we asked that the case be reopened. He said he'd study it and get back to us. He has now gotten back to us and told us that the case could not be reopened under Salvadoran law because the statute of limitations has run out on a murder case. El Salvador has a 10-year statute of limitations for murder. We don't necessarily agree with that conclusion, but certainly in 1985 we could have forced the Salvadoran government, and the United States government wouldn't have had any alternative if it had been publicly known that a high-ranking officer was implicated in the murders. I have no doubt that this matter would have been investigated at the time, or it would have very adversely affected the U.S. government's support for the Salvadoran government at the time. I have no doubt at all about that.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that Pickering, now the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, engaged in a cover-up, Scott Greathead?
Well, I don't know what was going on in Ambassador Pickering's mind or who made the decision that this information couldn't be disclosed to the families and Congress and the public. I'm not prepared to say that it was totally his responsibility, but it's something that I think we're entitled to know.
I also think, though, that
William Ford,
it's more accurate to realize that while Pickering may have had certain information coming to El Salvador in 1984, there were a number of other ambassadors there before Pickering. There were a number of political officers there who these files show had been told that Salvadoran military themselves suspected their brothers of participating in this murder. So I think it's more accurate to say that virtually from the time these women's bodies were found, that the U.S. Embassy had information that the Salvadoran military themselves believed that their brother officers had participated in this. So I think that this is a question of withholding information from the families from the very beginning and not beginning with any particular conversation with Ambassador Pickering.
Scott Greathead, were the Mary Knowles targeted in particular for the kind of work they did in El Salvador?
Oh, there's no question that Ida Ford and Maura Clark were the subject of threats and very close scrutiny by local military commanders in Chalatenango, where they were working for the poor. In addition, Jean Kazel, Dorothy Kazel and Jean Donovan were also apparently the subject of scrutiny by the Salvadoran National Police in the La Paz zone where they were working with members of the Cleveland Diocese. So there's no question at all, and there's a lot of evidence that the Salvadoran military at various levels was following the work of these women and other religious workers in Salvador very, very closely.
If people want to get a hold of the documents that you have gotten a hold of at the Lawyers Committee on for Human Rights, the special embassy evidence, where can they go on the web?
Well, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights has a website. You can look at the documents on their website. Also, the State Department has a website where they post documents that are disclosed pursuant to Freedom of Information Law requests. And so they're also available on the State Department's website.
Can you give both of those?
I can't right now. I'm clicking around for the Lawyers Committee website.
Well, I think I know the Lawyers Committee website. It is www.lchr.org. That's www.lchr.org. And phone number for the Lawyers Committee for those who are not yet internet literate?
I'm on the board of directors for the Lawyers Committee. Let me just get their phone number.
Okay. Actually, I also have that here. I've just been handed it. 212-754-1700. That's 212-754-1700. And I really would suggest people go to the website, if you can, to take a look at these documents, both the State Department website of the U.S. government, as well as the Lawyers Committee website, lchr.org. This is extremely significant, even 18 years later, as we continue to look at U.S. foreign policy. And finally, William Ford, what do you think should be done with the that people can do? You said that the U.S. government should bring the men from Florida up, subpoena them, find out exactly what they knew. But people around the country who have long been solidarity activists with Central America right now with all of this information.
Well, I think that they should be in touch with their congressional representatives and their senators to urge them to contact the Immigration Naturalization Service to have these men subpoenaed and questioned. They should also talk to their senators and congressional representatives about calling these men before the Congress of the United States in front of a television camera to testify under oath about what they knew.
Well, thank you again very much for being with us, William Ford, and Scott Great, head of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. William Ford, again, an attorney in New York City and the brother of Ida Ford, one of four church women killed by National Guardsmen in El Salvador in 1980, Dorothy Kazel, Jean Donovan, Ida Ford, and Maura Clark. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Perhaps it's these kinds of cases that would go before an international criminal court if there was one, and that's what we're going to talk about now. What has prevented an international criminal court being formed until this point? But right now, since one is being discussed in Rome during a 5-week conference, where does it stand right now? On this eve of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, the U.S. is continuing to fight efforts to create an international criminal court. In a statement released late last week from Rome, where 161 nations are meeting to establish a court, the U.S. said it fears American soldiers may be vulnerable to war crimes charges. The Pentagon says it's worried that American soldiers who unwittingly kill civilians during, quote, peacekeeping missions could find themselves facing charges of crimes against humanity. Washington says it will not support a court with no veto power for the U.S. Many other nations, however, believe that only a court free of U.S. domination will have teeth. We're joined by several people on the phone right now from Rome and here in the United States to talk about this international criminal court. We're going to start with Reed Brody, who is Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch in Rome, part of the group that is shaping this international criminal court. Reed, welcome to Democracy Now! Where does it stand right now, the proposal for an ICC?
Well, we're in the last week of this five-week conference, and things have become very polarized. What we see is a majority, a two-thirds majority of countries who support an independent court that would have an independent prosecutor that would be free from state and Security Council control and that would have full jurisdiction to look at war crimes, even in civil wars. On the other hand, you have a minority of countries, most vocally, as you pointed out, the United States, but also including Russia, China, India, and some others who are opposed to this kind of independence and this kind of intrusion into internal armed conflicts. And so this is a battle as we go into this last week. The United States last week threatened to, quote, actively oppose the court if the decisions came out against its positions. And what we're urging these like-minded majority countries like South Africa, South Korea, Argentina, Canada, Germany, most of our European allies that have lined up before a strong court, to stick by their principles and not capitulate to these American threats to sabotage the court.
Can you tell us, Reed Brody, if the U.S. has taken a harder line stance as the weeks have gone on?
Oh, most definitely. This threat to actively oppose the court is very new. The demarches, the lobbying that the United States is doing in foreign capitals to try to moderate other countries' positions has accentuated. Some of the U.S.'s positions, actual positions, have gotten harder, particularly as concerns crimes against humanity and limitations on the court's jurisdiction over states which don't ratify the treaty. All have hardened, actually, as the conference has gone along.
What about other countries?
Well, as I said, you have this majority of what are called like-minded countries who include most European countries, key democracies around the world like South Africa, led, I would say, by Germany, which has taken the most active role, who want a court that once a state ratifies the court's treaty, this court would be able to investigate fully within that state, a court that would be independent of certainly of the Security Council, a court which would have a prosecutor, and this is very important, who would not have to wait for the Security Council or a state to bring a complaint, but could take information from victims and from human rights organizations. We've seen in the past in human rights fora and in human rights courts that states don't complain against each other for diplomatic reasons, for economic reasons, for political reasons, especially don't complain against bigger states. And so we're calling for a court that has a prosecutor who can sift through the evidence and independently bring charges where people have committed genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes. Two-thirds of the states here support, more than two-thirds, actually 76% of the states that spoke on this last week supported a court with an independent prosecutor. Yet the United States has come out very strongly against an independent prosecutor and is pressuring delegations on this issue.
Reed Brody, we're also joined by Chris Simpson. Chris Simpson, who is an author in New York City and a professor in the School of Communication at American University. His book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, is a book that talks about, among other things, the history of U.S. involvement in shaping international human rights law and how it's been very carefully shaped from Nuremberg trials and before so that the U.S. would not be held responsible for crimes against humanity, for example, Native Americans being killed in this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Chris.
Good morning.
In just a minute, we're going to turn to you, Chris, and I want to ask if you would put the International Criminal Court effort in this context of the 20th century. But we have to first break for stations to identify themselves. Here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're talking about the International Criminal Court in the last week of a five-week conference in Rome, Italy right now. It is being hammered out by more than 150 countries. Reid Brody on the line with us from Rome. He is with the Human Rights Watch, and he is the advocacy director there. Chris Simpson, author of a number of books, his latest, Universities and Empire, Money and Politics and the Social Sciences During the Cold War, we'll speak about another time. But it was the earlier book, The Splendid Blonde Beast, that led us to call him, because it really documents how the U.S. has been involved in shaping international human rights law in the 20th century. Chris Simpson, I had just asked you about putting this effort at an international criminal court and the U.S. resistance to it in a historical context.
Well, I think a good place to start is actually in the contemporary situation. As recently as March of this year, Donald Sheffer, who is the U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes issues, in a speech in Los Angeles, says he's describing the strategy, the American strategy for the court is, let me emphasize, however, that we have a responsibility as U.S. negotiators to ensure that U.S. interests are advanced and protected in the creation of the court. This is his framing statement as far as American strategy for the negotiations for a world criminal court. That approach, that kind of central interest, has been characteristic of the American approach to war crimes panels since the turn of the century. There have been a number of different courts that in one way or another, and also tribunals, that in one way or another have attempted to prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity. There have been a mixed success. Now, I think that Mr. Brody's group has been very courageous and very effective in bringing human rights issues into the public arena at the same time. And I think in part what's going on now with the Clinton administration and even considering an international criminal court is in part a result of earlier pressure by Mr. Brody's group and others to put this on the agenda. But going back to World War I, for example, at the Versailles Conference, which was a treaty that brought World War I to a close, there were very specific, well-detailed proposals for an international criminal court to try people accused of war crimes of whatever nationality. And the important point there is it's not just the victors trying the vanquished, but that any person who against whom there was a reasonable case of committing a crime against humanity or a similar crime could be brought to trial. All through the 1920s, if you look at the law journals of of that particular period, 1930s, major discussions as to how to bring this sort of thing into being. And this, recall that this is before the Holocaust. This is before the questions of superior orders and that sort of thing that were eventually institutionalized at Nuremberg. Again, coming out of the International Tribunal at Nuremberg and the founding of the United Nations and so on, another series of proposals for various institutions that would advance the cause of justice in this way. One of the most well-known is the Genocide Convention, which is basically a definition of what genocide is and a pledge by countries, number one, not to do it, number two, to take particular steps to prevent it if it's going on. The United States refused to ratify the Genocide Convention for more than 40 years into the late 1980s, and it only ratified it in the late 1980s on the condition that it would not take effect in the U.S. without what is called implementing legislation. In other words, a separate vote of the U.S. Congress that would implement the Genocide Convention and make it part of U.S. law. That implementing legislation has yet to pass. So to sum up, the U.S. position today is consistent in its main aspects, in its main features, with the U.S. position that has been put forward since the turn of the century.
We're talking to Chris Simpson, who is a professor of the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C., and on the line with us, Reed Brody in Rome, and Rhonda Copeland, director of the International Women's Human Rights Law Clinic of CUNY Law School and the legal text coordinator for the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice in the International Criminal Court. Now, Rhonda Copeland, welcome to Democracy Now!, and tell us about where gender crimes, so-called gender crimes like rape, fit into this latest discussion about an international criminal court. Rhonda, can you hear me? Rhonda Copeland. Well, we can't hear Rhonda, but we're going to ask if Reed Brody could actually lay that out for us. We don't have either Reed Brody or Rhonda Copeland right now on the line with us. But, you know, one of the things that called our attention to this issue was a piece in the New York Times last Thursday that's by Alessandra Stanley. And it says, a dispute between women's groups and the Vatican over a legal term has broadened into a battle of religion and gender politics that could jeopardize agreement on whether rape will be declared a war crime by an international criminal court. There's wide consensus at the United Nations conference that rape is a war crime that should be prosecuted by an international tribunal. Women's groups have fought to have a treaty include enforced pregnancy as a war crime for the act of impregnating women and forcing them to bear children as tools of ethnic reprisal, as in the case of forcing Croatian women to have Serbian babies. The Vatican agrees that such rapes are war crimes, but is troubled by the term enforced pregnancy, fearing it could be broadly interpreted as an invitation to challenge anti-abortion laws in many countries. And that dispute has polarized many of the 159 delegations that have only days left to negotiate rules for a permanent tribunal to prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity. This, again, a reading from a piece in the New York Times on Thursday that goes on to say, the battle has become one of the most glaring and painful examples of just how contentious and intractable the process of negotiating a treaty on war crimes is. The issue of enforced pregnancy is marginal next to the more fundamental questions about the court's jurisdiction and authority, but it's one of many seemingly secondary issues that could thwart a consensus. It quotes one member of a Western delegation who asked not to be named, saying everybody's consumed by whether the big five issues can be resolved, but we're forgetting that items 6 through 30 could just as easily throw a wrench into a successful negotiation of the treaty. There's universal support at the conference for the principle that individuals who commit genocide or other atrocities should be held accountable. But as they negotiate the details, delegates remain deeply divided over some of the most fundamental issues of the court's jurisdiction. Reed Brody has just talked with us about some of those issues. We're joined right now, though, by Rhonda Copeland, who is the director of the International Women's Human Rights Law Clinic at CUNY Law School, now in Rome, as coordinator, the legal text coordinator for the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rhonda.
Hi, Amy. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice. Well, I was just reading from the New York Times article. You may have gotten a chance to see it this past Thursday, Semantic Stalls Pact Labeling Rape a War Crime. Where does this stand today?
Well, I think that what we're facing in terms of the Women's Caucus, which you know is representing a group of women from around the world and is represented here by women around the world, is a systematic attack on the basic principles of gender justice. And those are two parts. One is that the court should have jurisdiction over all of the serious crimes of sexual violence and gender persecution that women disproportionately suffer in these situations. And the second part of that is that the court be equipped to do gender justice, which means, for example, that there be gender experts among the judges and the prosecutors. And what we're fighting on today, right at this very minute, is that the principle that there shall be no discrimination of any kind in the application of the law by the court, and particularly that there be no discrimination based on gender, is completely fundamental. In terms of the New York Times article of last week, what has happened is that a that an attack by the Vatican, joined by the Islamic countries, this is basically the unholy alliance of Beijing, has sought to remove one of the crimes of sexual violence, which is the crime of forced pregnancy, from the statute. And as a result of that, the whole clause that applies to sexual violence, which includes rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, and other forms of sexual violence, is being held up over this issue about forced pregnancy. Our understanding of the intent of the conference is that none of the other crimes are at issue, and there is an attempt going on to try to negotiate the forced pregnancy issue with our opponents by some of the states. But there is also the concern in this process that things that have had to do with justice for women have been consistently opened up, even when under the rules you would have assumed that they are settled and negotiated texts. We do not think that the issue of the other sexual violence crimes will be opened up here, but we're not confident at resting until the last dot is on this document, precisely because if the Arab League states raise an issue, if the Vatican raises an issue, then suddenly something that's totally settled, like the word gender in the document, or like all of the crimes, including forced pregnancy, which was previously settled, are then open for discussion.
What do you say to the Vatican, as well as many Islamic countries and American anti-choice lobby groups who are there, who say that this term enforced pregnancy is too general and could be used to challenge countries that have anti-abortion laws on their books?
I think that the fact of the matter is that the Women's Caucus has gone a long way, further than the need be. It's gone a long way to say that that is not the intent. Under international law, you can't make criminal abortion laws a crime under the statute, and you can't make the failure to provide abortion a crime under the statute. And we've even been willing to say that. This is a ploy on their part because they politically don't want the term forced pregnancy used. In our view, it's critical to have the term because the prosecutor needs a checklist of crimes against women. And what we know is even when crimes are specifically mentioned, they get ignored by prosecutors. And certainly this one has been historically ignored until, you know, it came to light in such a fierce way in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
It also came to light in Rwanda, is that right? And is this a crime that is being prosecuted in the Rwandan ad hoc war crimes tribunals that are taking place right now?
Well, what's happening in the Rwandan tribunals is actually a really good example of why we have to fight so hard for the naming of crimes here and for the principle that gender-aware and sensitive and committed personnel and gender principles have to be at the heart of this court. In Rwanda, despite a monitoring project, despite an intervention that actually forced them to charge sexual violence in the first case before the tribunal, they have issued a number of indictments subsequently where they even mention that sexual violence is occurring, but they do not charge it as a separate crime. And that is the failure to punish specifically for sexual violence against women. So despite all the pressure, right, we still have not succeeded in getting consistent charges out of the Rwanda tribunal. And they've never charged rape as a grave crime. They've charged it as humiliating and degrading treatment once. And they haven't charged forced pregnancy. Now, that's a different, you know, that's a problem that has to come up in the individual instances. But the other problem here is that when you think about what forced pregnancy is, it is when women are made pregnant as a result of rape, whether or not they are detained to keep them pregnant, as they were in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and as some women were in Rwanda in the context of forced marriages, temporary forced marriages or other kind of confinement. Our basic principle is that if you rape a woman and she becomes pregnant as a result of rape, you are responsible not only for rape, but you are responsible for forced pregnancy. It's like shooting someone, meaning to hit them in the arm, and you hit them in the heart. You get prosecuted for homicide. It's the same principle here. On the other hand, we're not even sure that we can hold that principle in the definition of forced pregnancy.
Rhonda Copeland, for people to understand how the whole lobbying process in Rome works right now for creating this historic new body, an international criminal court, how then does your whole press for rape to be included as a war crime and also enforce pregnancy fit into the general argument that, for example, the U.S. is making against the International Criminal Court, that they want veto power over who is brought before a criminal court? Obviously, specifically, they don't want American soldiers brought before it, charged with rape or anything else.
Well, one thing that is absolutely you should be absolutely clear about is that the Women's Caucus is not only arguing for the specific jurisdiction and structures to make gender justice possible, but we see that the independent prosecutor, that automatic jurisdiction, that the avoidance of state consent, that the avoidance of Security Council power to delay this court, and that full jurisdiction over crimes in internal armed conflict are essential if there is to be gender justice as well as justice for anyone. For example, if there's no independent prosecutor, the crimes against women are the first ones to fall off the table of the states, you know, who would otherwise have the power, or the Security Council, who would otherwise have the power. We can't tolerate that. There needs to be an independent prosecutor in order that all the crimes, and very particularly the crimes against women,
Rhonda Copeland,
come before the court.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Rhonda Copeland, again, is the legal text director of the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice that's at the International Criminal Court right now. And their website is iccwomen@igc.org. iccwomen@igc.org. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Tomorrow, we take a look at Cuba and all the terrorist attempts against its leader and the people for the last 40 years. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Works the coffer for tell us even if I was selling any neck brain it is certain is no one no. All this has can it me so I was revealing the one. First lock look at old meme and I'll cry on it all but sell to me more good than this name, Mr.